But if you'll just grab your Bible this morning, preemptively flip to Acts 28, and we will pick up where we left off. And I'm going to rewind just one verse, which would be verse 8 this morning, and then we'll get through verse 15. So one morning, Jesus gathered the disciples, and he said, we're going to go on a journey. Don't worry about grabbing anything. Just trust me, we'll go. And so they set out that morning. And they were on their way, and somewhere around lunchtime, Jesus said, hey, would you all pick up a stone? And so they all grabbed a rock, and they began to journey through the rest of the day. And as they got to their destination that evening, Jesus said, did you guys all keep your rock with you? And of course, they had, because they wanted to be obedient, good disciples. And Jesus said, thank you for trusting me. And he said, let's all pray together. And so they did. And when he prayed over them and the rocks, all of their rocks turned to bread. And so he said, here's your provision for the day. Thank you for being obedient and trusting and journeying with me. And so they all had their bread for that day, and they ate it, and everything was pretty amazing, because that's impressive. And so the next morning, Jesus said, hey, would you all grab a rock? And so they set out that morning, and Peter, being wiser than most, decided that if he wanted a little more to eat, he should grab a bigger rock. And so he did. And so that morning, instead of grabbing just a small stone, he thought, I'm a little bit hungrier today because we've had a day's journey. And so he grabbed a larger rock. And so they journeyed through the day as they had before. And that evening, as they gathered around the fire again, Jesus said, hey, did you guys all grab your rock? And Peter proudly presented his rock. And he said, will you trust me with the work that we have to do, and the labor and the journey? And of course, they all said, yes, Jesus, we trust you. And so he said, would you all hand me your rocks? And so they did. They created a pile of stones in front of Jesus, and he prayed over them. And he said, I wanted to bless you, and I wanted you to know that the provision that we have is provision from the Father. And so he said, as you take your bread today, would you share it? Would you break it with one another? And so they did that. And so they all grabbed their small loaves to Peter's one big loaf that had turned into bread, and he broke it up, and they shared. And as they broke more and more, and the bread had multiplied so that there were piles of bread left over at the end of the night. And Peter was so elated, and he just couldn't believe it. He could hardly sleep that night. And so they went to sleep. And the next morning, they went to set out, and Peter let everybody get just a little bit ahead. And so he began to collect the piles of leftover now rocks. They had turned back to rocks. But what was bread? And Peter thought, tonight, I'm going to make sure everybody has plenty to eat. Jesus won't have to do anything. And so he began to collect these rocks, and he found as many as he could, and he put them in his bag for the journey. He began to journey just behind the group that day. And so it was a little bit cumbersome, but he was just thinking ahead of time how great it was going to be when they arrived at the campfire that night, and he presented all of the feast that he had planned. And so he journeyed through the day thinking about that, and as his shoulder and his back began to get heavy and sore from the journey and carrying this load, he plopped down all the rocks, and they began to camp around the fire. And Jesus said, I want to thank you again for journeying with me and trusting me with provision. He said, would you all go grab a stick? See, he hadn't asked them to grab rocks that morning. He didn't ask them to do anything, but they all went, and they grabbed a stick. And when they put it over the fire, a giant fish was on the fire. And so they all had fish for that evening. They didn't eat the rocks that Peter had lugged along for the whole day. This amazing fish. And Peter, being a fisherman, as they broke into the fish that night, was the most fresh and delicious fish that he had ever had. He could hardly sleep. They ate their fill. They all had a fish, and it was just an amazing night. And as he thought about this, he couldn't get to sleep. He looked at the pile of rocks. He looked at the sticks, and he decided that night that he would go and he would collect enough sticks for all the disciples and rocks for the next day. And as he fashioned some sort of sledge to kind of drag this along, he was ready the next morning as they set out, but he had kind of dilly-dallied in the last little bit and kept putting all the rocks on the sledge. And so the rest of the group had kind of set out before him, before Peter had gotten the opportunity. And so they had journeyed on the way. And Peter, that day, of course, being burdened now with an extra set of sticks on top of the pile of rocks, lagged way behind. And he just was struggling to get into the camp that evening as he drug and was tired and just at the end of what he could possibly do. But he just consoled himself with the idea that he was going to provide the bounty for that evening. It was with Jesus, he was gonna bless it, and they were gonna probably name him second in command, right? I mean, after all of this work, how could they not? And he was just so proud of himself. And as he drug in to the camp that night, everybody was already around the fire, and Jesus looked down and said, "Oh, Peter, it's good of you to join us. We were just talking about how this morning we agreed that we were gonna just pray and fast this evening around the fire." And Peter's heart dropped. Right? He was devastated. All the work, all the time he put into it, all the anticipation of what he was going to do. And of course, he grudgingly said, "Yes, of course." And so they prayed around the fire, but he could hardly hear the words of the others because his stomach was grumbling. And that night he went to bed and he was just crestfallen, right? And so the next morning, he knew that Jesus had never asked them to fast 2 days in a row. And so he woke up extra early, determined not to drag behind today. He set out earlier than the rest of the group. And he went double time. And he made sure he went a day's journey, lugged all of it down to where he thought they would camp that night. He began to make the camp. He built the fire and he waited. And of course, he was again thinking about how great this was all gonna be once they all showed up. And he wasn't sure that Jesus would promote him as new leader, but it was probably gonna be co-leadership at this point, right? For all of the work that Peter had put in and just thinking about all the provision. And he knew, look, I know that Jesus said that this was provision for us and he's the one that's blessed it. But if we do this the right way, we could turn a profit, right? All we gotta do is just make sure we got a couple sticks and some bread. It's gonna be so great. And he's waiting and it gets later and later and later. And finally, he only sees one person walking slowly up the road. And of course, it's Jesus. Jesus came on and said, "Peter, I'm glad I found you finally." And he's like looking behind Jesus. He said, "Where's the rest of the guys? You know, I've got all of this ready." And of course, Jesus said, "Well, you took off so quickly this morning that you got ahead of us. And what you missed is that I sent all of your brothers into the town surrounding us. And I told them to go find people to do ministry to. They probably could have used your help this morning." Peter was a little frustrated and he had mixed emotions. He wanted to do the right thing and he had an anxiety because he'd stayed up and he'd worked so hard and all of his work seemed to come to nothing. And Jesus asked him a few questions. He said this, "Did you carry these because I asked you to?" Now Peter rewound to the first day and he thought, yes, he did ask me to carry these things. "Peter, where are your brothers?" And well, he didn't know because he hadn't heard the instructions for that day and he'd kind of, since the second day, really fallen out of tune with them and really hadn't been a part of any of the discussions or any of the teaching that was happening. He says, "They're missing your help, Peter. Peter, did you carry these for me?" Which Peter thought, "I don't know." Then he said, "Did you carry these for them?" Well, he had thought he was carrying them for them. Yeah, I have these sticks. I thought with all the bread and the fish that we would all share in this feast. Jesus said, "You missed much of this journey with me. Peter, in your anxiousness and your anticipation, you set out ahead of me. You fell behind me. You've done a lot of work and you've struggled, but all you have is a pile of sticks and stones that without me are worthless." And so Peter's like totally conflicted. He doesn't know what to do about this. And Jesus said, I just asked you to journey with me and to trust me on the way, and I provided. And the whole point of this was so that I could see who you were serving and how you were serving. All right, I made that story up, but you could see Peter doing something like that, right? I mean, you could see Peter just thinking how he was gonna get it all done and how he tried and how he'd kind of run ahead and then fallen behind and he worked and he worked and he worked and all he had at the end of the thing was just something to show about his work. And he had kind of forsaken the task that they'd been given and trust and all of that. And so the question this morning is about what it means to journey with God, journeying with God. And I think we generally think that we have that down pat, but we have journey with God as more of a title or an idea. Because if you asked Peter, was he journeying with Jesus? He would have said, yeah. But at any point in that journey, you could have not found Jesus anywhere to be around or the rest of the disciples. And so the question is like, are we journeying with Jesus? Are we journeying with Jesus? Or are we thinking we're doing things ahead of schedule because that's what Jesus wants of us, because he's actually asked us to do those things? Or are we just doing them in his name, but they're really for us? Or we think we're serving other people and we think that we're working hard for the kingdom, when in reality, we're just anxiously toiling away and not resting in the provision that would actually be given. Now, we're at a point in the book of Acts that there could be a lot of different ways to go. And I feel as we're winding down an impressing truth that perhaps we've divorced ourselves from the reality that this story about Paul is really a story for us to be encouraged, because we think of all the things that Paul accomplished and we think, well, that's Paul. I can't participate in that level. And for whatever reason, you might have that excuse. The reality of the journey is this. You have overemphasized that metaphor, and it's just a metaphor. It's just a metaphor. The journey of life is taken by all. But the journey of faith adds a new element. There's something different and distinct about a faith journey, and that's what we're asked to do, to take our journey of life in faith, and whatever that looks like and materializes, would in the end, as we look back in retrospect, when you get to the end of our lives, we could say the same kinds of things about our life if we walked faithfully that Paul's able to say about his. Not because we've missionalized continents, but because we were faithful and God used our lives of faith to spread his grace and his truth and be a redemptive presence as we go. Now, with that in mind, I'm gonna pray for our text and our time in the word this morning. If you'll pray with me, and then we'll get to it and see what the Lord would have us learn this morning. Father, we love you. I pray for just the remaining time that we have to open your truth. Help us to understand that it's about faith on our walk and our lives. Call us to a new reality and to maybe lay down some of our anxious toil that we've busied ourselves with. Help us this morning to just sit and rest and hear afresh of your promises, that we would walk then in those, and that you would, because of your strength and your blessing and your spirit and your power, that we would walk through our faith journeys of life as a redemptive presence, and you would use that for your glory, however big and however small that looks. So we thank you for your word and these promises. Give us eyes to see you this morning in your word, your shape, your form, ears to hear your voice speaking, and hearts to receive what you would say. We love you. Ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. So we're going to go Acts 28. I'm going to start in verse 8 just to kind of give 9 more context. But essentially, they're shipwrecked on an island. They being Paul, Luke, and Aristarchus. And they've landed after no power of their own on this island of Malta. And they've begun this snake bite tragedy was the beginning of this this time on Malta, and because of that, Paul is able to minister the gospel in illustrative form through his experience of being snake bitten, and he survives that. And then we find out in verse 8 that it happened that the father of Publius lay sick, that's the head man on the island, with fever and dysentery, and Paul visited him, and he prayed, and putting his hands on him, his snake bitten yet preserved hands, he prayed for him, and he healed him. Now, that's what's just happened, but because of all of that, because of that whole story playing out before the eyes of the barbarians, as they're called, or the natives of that island, they didn't share a common language, and so the ministry had to come from some other way, and this was it. Now, we learn in verse 9, it says, now when that had taken place, when then this, that's the whole thing, the laying on of hands, the praying, and the healing, when that had taken place, it says, then the rest of the people on the island who had diseases also came, and they were cured. Now, what you need to know about this word for healed in the first time, when in verse 8, when Paul laid his hands on the Publius' father, it was a miracle healing. This word now for healed has to do, the Greek is therapeo, right? It's a therapeutic, and it points to not a miracle healing, but the fact that Luke and Aristarchus and whoever else would have had the opportunity were ministering medical attention to people that needed it. So this isn't Paul divinely healing people. This is people in need coming and being ministered to. Now, God invests our journey with purpose. And we often think, my journey's about me, and at the end of it, I'm going to be a better person. And that's true. You should be more and more like Christ. You grow in maturity and holiness. That should be at the end of your road. But your road is not just all about you. We miss often the collective purpose in our journeying together. That by being banded together, that he has Luke and Aristarchus there, Paul is being ministered to in the sense that they're able to come underneath and help Paul in this now missions effort on this island. So God invests our journey with purposes that are outside of ourselves, outside of the collective people that we know and who happen to be the immediate journeyers with us, like maybe fans, friends and family or church family. But beyond that, he invests us with a redemptive mission wherever we go. And that doesn't always look like salvation. It doesn't always look like a church being planted and some great revival happening. Genesis 50, at the very end of the book, we get this word from Joseph, who has had this tragic tale of being hated by his brother. He's a child of promise, and he's hated, and he's thrown in a pit. If you don't know the story, he's sold into slavery. He's falsely accused of rape. He's thrown in prison. He spends a long time languishing there. And then eventually, he works his way up to be the second in command of all of Egypt. And then he finally has this opportunity to reconcile with his family. And what he says is that famous line, which is, "What you intended for evil, God intended for good." And then the second half of that sentence is so important. And he said this, "So that many will be kept alive as they are today." Because Joseph was given the gift by God to interpret the dreams, he rightly interpreted there was a famine coming. And so they had saved up food, which was the precipitative event that brought his family back together. But the whole point of Joseph being second in command was not so that Joseph would be second in command of all of Egypt, as though that was an end in itself, or so that this family would be reconciled and that the promise would be preserved. Yet that's also amazing. But so that a land, a people in all of Egypt would just be preserved life. And that's God's kindness, his grace. And he's working that redemptive presence through one person in that story, but that's no different from us. That God's intention is for you to be a redemptive presence wherever you are. That means that you are just an expression of God's grace, whether it be common grace or special grace that is specific about the gospel and wherever you are at. So here is, I see a same kind of thing happening. Paul has a specific opportunity. Normally, wherever he goes, he gets real explicit in the gospel, and he wants to see many come to faith, and of course, that would be his mission here too. But what they end up doing is just healing the main man of the island, if you want to say it that way, and his father of a disease, and then they give medical attention to those that needed it. The purposes in our trials are not always seen in the fruit that they bear to us directly. Like, you might want to say, "I went through that thing so that I could get here." And sometimes we get that fruit, but sometimes we don't get that. And sometimes it's way delayed. Now, we find out as they pull out of Dodge here, there's no mention of anybody coming to Christ. There's no mention of a church being planted. Now, historically, we're told that there is a great church planted. And now the nation of Malta is a Christianized nation. It's mostly Catholic, but we'll leave that for a minute. So sometimes the fruit is way further down the road than you have ever expected. And yet God is using your redemptive presence, your faithfulness along the way to write his story on the hearts of all of history. Whether that means people come explicitly to faith or not, or he's just using them to heal some diseases and nurse the people to health that were there. Now, it says in the next verse, "They also honored us greatly. And when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed." Now, they could have gone about thinking, well, as soon as we leave here, we've got to set sail for Rome, because that's what we set out to do. And so we've got to at least get jobs here and start earning a wage and have to buy provisions so that when we get to Rome, there's a lot of ways this could have gone differently to supply for themselves. But in the way of walking in faithfulness, that God chose to use these largely, as long as we can tell, unredeemed people to in turn bless and supply Paul and his traveling partners. And they load them up with provision. And it's not they honored us by giving us provisions. they actually put them in a place of honor. And there's a secondary thing. We honored them. We put them in a place of prominence. We thanked them for coming. We thought how great and humbled we are that you would come by whatever divine hand brought you here, Paul and Luke and Aristarchus. And so they just honored them as they put them on. And they give them anything they needed, which is incredible if you think about that. And so we see that the detours and the trials that got them there was not anything that they had planned along the way, right? But God is using it, one, to provision and bless them, and two, to provision and bless those people. And so as they're loaded up with everything for the journey, they're now able to continue on without any extra struggle or any anxiety about whether or not they'll have what they need as they go on. It says, after 3 months, then, we set sail. Now, if you've forgotten, they set sail too early. It was the bad part of the season. You don't travel after the fast. But they had, which led to the great storm and the shipwreck and so on. But now they've waited that out. So they wait 3 months for the first open window, if you will, to journey on. And so they waited for 3 months and they set sail in a ship that had wintered in the island, which is unique and interesting because this is also a ship from Alexandria, which was the same ship or the same origination point that they had started with. And yet God had somehow put this ship here. This wasn't a normal place to winter. Like, you're close enough to Rome that if you'd gotten this far, there was no reason why you wouldn't have journeyed further. So there's just one more thing that God had planned and appointed beforehand. It's just a detail that I think adds to our awareness about how God's hand is on this whole thing. And so they find this ship that had wintered at the island, a ship of Alexandria, and it tells us this interesting detail with the twin gods as a figurehead. These twin gods were the patron saints, if you will, of sailors. They were supposed to provide safe journey and travel, and especially for those kind of sailors that were shipwrecked. So there's a touch of irony in this statement, and that Luke observes that they set sail on this ship that was supposed to be, quote unquote, protected by these twin gods. But we know, sort of parenthetically, because we have the backstory, that it's not the twin gods that will ensure the safety of this journey, and it hadn't ensured the safety of their journey either. And so they had set sail with these twin gods as the figurehead. Now, I want to stop and just observe something for a moment. Because when we think about our journey and when we reflect on it, it's much easier to pick out the provisions, the meticulous grace that God's given in each separate thing that's happened, some event, whether it went well or whether it went poorly, something we hadn't expected that ends up being a provision on the way. And in hindsight, we pick those up really well. And if I said, hey, because of those things that Jesus did and how the way that God provisioned you in the past, should that shape your way going forward? And you would say, well, yeah, I think so, right? Now, I want you to ask yourself, but is that generally what you do? And I think the answer is no. And the reason is because when we plan journeys, we plan them in straight lines, right? We're going from here to there. And if there's going to be a shipwreck or not a shipwreck between here and there, I prefer not shipwreck. Yes? Right. Yeah, so that when we plan journeys, even though we've seen God be faithful when we were making bad decisions or other people were making bad decisions, right? Here again, the story of Joseph. Here again, the story of Moses. Here again, the story of Jonah, right? Even in our sinful decisions or other people's sinful decisions against us, and God's kindness and grace and his consistency, we still tend not to plan in a way that says, I trust God for the next thing. We just say, no, I'd like to take the destination, the nonstop flight from here to there. Now, if anybody deserves a nonstop flight to where his destination is, I guess it's gonna be Paul, right? It's gotta be Paul. But Paul shows us something in his journey that we need to learn, which is you don't set the course. There's only the illusion of setting the course, right? And then you find out along the way as you fumble through and things get rearranged and planned again, whether or not you were actually faithful to that reality. And so this is the challenge then. It's not whether or not you're journeying with God. It's your life reflective that you're trusting God on that journey, right? And just think of my silly parable at the beginning. Peter was journeying with Jesus, but he wasn't really trusting Jesus to provide for him. He wanted to provide for himself. He wanted to run ahead, and he lagged behind because of the work that he was putting in, and we forget that that's not what Jesus has called us to. We must trust not just in his provision for the things, but also the places and the pace that he sets for us. It says they delayed 3 months, which is a function of the weather and out of necessity. But if you just think about this for a second, it's like God saying, just slow down. I'm gonna give you 3 months where the people are gonna honor you. They're gonna provision you. You don't have to struggle or worry. You're gonna be fine. And there's an underlying irony in this whole thing, or I don't know if that's the right word for it, but the island of Malta in Phoenician, which is the language that they spoke, means refuge or place of refuge. So this is an interesting thing that God provides this sort of Sabbath experience just before Paul gets to his final destination. Now, this is the destination that Paul himself had even set out as. The last time Paul actually set his own destination was way back in Acts chapter 8 when he was headed to Damascus to find some Christians to persecute. And that was when Christ confronted him and he converted him. And then since then, it's been this. I will show you how much you must suffer for my name. I'll bring you before kings and governors. You are going to be my witness, Paul. And so there you have the purpose in Paul's journey is the same purpose in our journey, to trust God and wherever we go, however we go, and with whoever's there, and with whatever he gives us, right? There's all the things that you think about that make up your quote-unquote journey of life. It's not a separate thing. You're going through life. God's provisioned you with stuff. He's provisioned you with people and relationships. He's given you opportunities. And then he sets a pace. Our problem is that we sort of separate these things out and we begin to run sort of a spiritual religious race and then the rest of our lives. And we kind of separate those things. And God has designed us to be a people of work and rest. And both our rest and our work should be fueled by faith. That the principle of the Sabbath that God instituted for the nation of Israel was, trust me, I'll provide for you on the journey. Collect some food the day before the Sabbath. You've got to do some work. You don't have to collect more food than you need, just enough for one day's for your whole family. And then you trust me and I'll feed you for that day. But guess what? Don't save that food because it won't feed you the next day. It'll go bad. So the principle of Sabbath was work because you trust me and rest because you trust me. In our lives, we find ourselves mostly backwards from that scenario. We run in the times we're supposed to rest, and we rest in the times we're supposed to run. That's not a faithful way to trust. You let Jesus set the pace, and whatever opportunity he gives you, you just say, how do I be faithful in this? I need to wait here. We've got some time, and we're just gonna rest in what God's given us, and when he gives you the opportunity to minister and work and do, you do. So now, here they are, journeying to Rome, by other people's decisions, other people's hands, but God's provisioning, even from unrighteous sources, if you want to think about it that way. And it says, putting in at Syracuse then, we stayed there for 3 days. So they travel north to Syracuse and they go just by Sicily, which is the center of the universe, by the way. It's just for me, if I'm Italian. So they go, So putting in at Syracuse, we stayed there for 3 days. They have a respite there. And then from there, we made a circuit and arrived at Rhegium. And after 1 day, a south wind sprang up. And on the second day, we came to Puteoli. Now, the only thing you need to know about that is that wind double-timed them an extra 200 miles, so they made it to their destination rather quick. So finally, after months of delay, setting out and from Caesarea on his appeal to the Roman Caesar, we find now these words. There we found brothers, and we were invited to stay with them for 7 days. And so we came to Rome. And that's a big ha. And so we came to Rome. Finally, where he was told he was going to go, he's out there. There's only one Caesar to appeal to. There's only one true king in all the land, and this is him. And now he's in the land of the Roman Caesar. And so we see sort of Paul arriving at his destination, if you will, but it's not really his final point. And then we get this word here that there's some brothers already in Rome, which should impress you because Paul's never been to Rome. This is his first time there. What he has done though is written the book of Romans, what we call the book, but he wrote as a letter and it had preceded him and it had evidently generated faith and either those who were faithful Jews and who had been converted somewhere along the way also had migrated here, but for whatever reason, they were able to find some brothers who they were able to stay with as they already had arrived in Rome. And it says, And the brothers there, when they heard about us, came as far as the Forum of Appius and three taverns to meet us. And on seeing them, Paul thanked God and took courage. Now, what you might expect to find at the end of the letter of Romans that Paul had written in the hopes that he would be able to convert some in Rome to this new faith in the Jewish Messiah is that when Paul arrived, the brothers saw him and they took courage. Aha, somebody to help. Paul's here. Can you believe it? Now, there's that element. That's true. That happened. But it says Paul took courage. Paul was strengthened. Paul was encouraged by the brothers that were there. It doesn't ever tell us that Paul was discouraged, though. We don't have any insight that like he was feeling downcast or trodden down or that he wasn't having the effect that he'd hoped he had. But as he sees these brothers coming and they come to greet him, behind the language there, they come out and they greet him, Paul is encouraged. Now, you might think, well, that's just good because, you know, he gets to see that Rome had had some belief before he had ever arrived. And that's true, but the places that are mentioned there are the Forum of Appius and three taverns. Now, I want to tell you, in Rome, that you know that saying, all roads lead to Rome, okay? Rome was the first nation and empire to build a superhighway. They had a highway from the capital all the way to the eastern coast, and it was called the Appian Way. And so they had built this, I think it's, I don't even want to give you miles, in excess of 400, I think, but don't quote me on that. So they have this main thoroughfare that runs through the whole country. And so what happens is as they set to land, somehow these brothers had heard that Paul was there. And they travel, the Forum of Appius to get to where Paul was 44 miles. They travel 44 miles to greet Paul. And that's why Paul took courage. Because these brothers who he didn't know anything about had traveled more than a grueling day's distance. Now, if you don't know how far 44 miles is, if you began walking right now out this door, walk down the street, turn right on Arapahoe, and begin walking up I-25, how far do you think you'd get? Past Castle Rock, through Monument, all the way to Larkspur, and if you turned right, if you just looked to the right on I-25 at 44 miles, you'd be staring at the Air Force Academy stadium. That's 44 miles. That's how far this band of brothers walked to greet Paul, who had just sent this letter before them. And this is why Paul takes courage in this truth, because of that, because they had gone out of their way to greet him as a brother that he had no awareness of. Now, that's all good for Paul and perhaps encouraging for us, but I want to help you see something about the journey. In Hebrews chapter 11, it's called the Hall of Faith. We get this chapter about what faith looks like in people in the past. And it goes through the gamut of Abraham and Moses and all those that had kind of preceded and what they did in faith, trusting in God. And it says they've done these things in faith. The actions that they took in their life proved their faith in God. And then it's followed then by Hebrews chapter 12. Obviously, it comes after chapter 11. But we get this then comparison about the journey of our lives. And so the first thing that says therefore, so it's banking on what we just heard about in all of chapter 11 about all of the people walking in faith and what they've done and how they trusted God, even though they haven't received the promise necessarily yet. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Now, you hear this, and then you're going to hear the next line and think something wrong. And I want to correct this before you get there. Witnesses are not spectators. Witnesses are proof of something happening. Witnesses, when you call a witness, they're not there to watch the trial. They're there to speak about something that's true, right? A witness. Now, the author of Hebrews says, therefore, since we're surrounded in our faith, in our walk, by this kind of testimony, by the witnesses, therefore, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. See, if you interpret that wrong, you read, therefore, since we have all these spectators in guilt and shame, we should run as hard as we can, even if we're tired. But that's not what it says. It says, because we have the testimony of how people walked in faith before us and that they reached the end, we should run with that kind of endurance because they're testifying to us that there's truth in the provision. There's a source, there's a goal that you get to that's unchangeable. So run with endurance knowing that that's true. Now, there's an addition to that or shaping of that, and it says what we're supposed to do. Looking to Jesus. So our attention really isn't fixed on the witnesses, but it's saying, hey, if you need some motivation, if you need some means about doing this, here's the testimony. You're surrounded in the faith with a cloud of witnesses, but it says, looking to Jesus, who's the founder and the perfecter of our faith. That's the beginning and the end, the author and the finisher. He's the pioneer, the one that walked before us and established the faith, but then also the completion of it, the perfecter of it. There's a couple ways you could take this, and I think they're both intended, and so they're both good, and I'll give them both to you. So the first is this, yes, what he began in you, he'll complete. The beginning of your faith, Christ, in faith, is going to be completed in the same way, in faith. But also, Jesus is the beginning. He is the purpose. He is also the end. So that it's not, I started with faith in Jesus and then I ran until I was holy and equal to Jesus. No, how you began it is how you ended. He perfected it. The beginning is the end. Does that make sense in some way? He is the beginning and the end. He's the author and the finisher. He's the perfecter of our faith. Now it's going to give you how that looked for Jesus, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, knowing that he would experience this. It's giving us, as Jesus had, quote unquote, an example of faith. Now, Jesus doesn't have to be unsure about anything, which should tell you something about the nature of faith. It's not an unsure thing. It's knowing what will be the outcome of this. In faith, in for the joy that he knew would be at the other side of the cross, he experienced it, despising the shame, and now the goal, the completion of Jesus' faith is that he's seated at the right hand of God. Therefore, you have the source to look to him. So you're looking him. That's the prize of the upward of the heavenly calling. Is your goal is to go forward and upward and just to trust God, not to run to a specific destination. And that's the problem. Your destination is not a place. It's not a certain like amount of achievement. It's not how many rocks you carried or sticks you collected, right? It's none of those things. It is trusting Christ, just to trust him more and more. That's how you advance on the journey. That's how you glorify God with your life. That's how you have a redemptive presence wherever you go, because he's working through you, and in faith, you're trusting him and you're walking, and he's doing ministry to you, to those that are around you and through you, whether that means salvations or not. Now, I've got a couple more points and then we'll be finished. Journeying with God is not separate from our journey of life. And I think that's just the primary thing. We separate that out and we think, we kind of do this waiting. I'm doing really well on my spiritual journey. And your spiritual journey is your life. And so you don't get to like segregate things out and say, I'm doing really well over here. But in my life, I do whatever I want. I pursue the ends that I want. I go after the things that I think I need. And I provision myself along the way. And I hope to reach some goals. I've set some destinations. And then along the way, I hope in the meantime, if I get the opportunity, I'll settle down. I'll trust God occasionally. And then I'll do some things for him. That's how we think about our lives. Like, I think if you're honest, you do this. And the journey is all one and the same. And so you need to see that I know who I'm speaking with. And if you feel tired, like I don't have anything else to give on the journey. I don't know what else I can contribute. I've given all that I can. I'm physically worn out. First, let me ask you, have you divorced like your doing and your trying from what God's actually asked you to do? Are you doing more than you need to do? Are you doing something that you ought not to do? You should set aside. Are you working hard for your pile of sticks and stones? If I'm ever doing something by myself, I'm working for myself, I begin to get like grudging towards other people. right? They could help me with this. Think how Peter was, you know, thinking about, he's lugging these rocks and none of these other guys are helping out and he's getting bitter and bitter towards them, right? And if you look at your work that way, it's unfulfilling. And if you find your source in yourself and it's only to feed you, at the end of the day, you will be tired. You'll be unfulfilled. You'll have nothing to show for faith at the end of your journey. So I just want you to, first of all, see, ask that question. Am I just like doing busy work? Am I struggling to carry rocks around so that I have a pile of rocks? If so, here's my commendation. Here's my recommendation. And here's what the Bible commands. Throw aside every weight and sin. Those are separate things. The bulk. If you're gonna run a race that requires endurance, you don't go find your parka, you don't wear all the clothes you have, you don't find an extra carry-on, you don't lug a suitcase behind you, you do none of those things. You get rid of every possible extra thing that you don't need, right? And even some things you do need so that you can get to the end. You throw it all aside, right? Lay aside every bulk and weight. It's possible all of your anxiousness and doing and your tiredness is not because God has given you a task that you can't accomplish. You are not an 88 Ford Festiva trying to climb Pike's Peak. That's not the task he's given you. And he's not asked you to do any of it alone. We are not designed to work alone, to be loners. When man was put in the garden and God said, everything is good. The first thing he said that was not good is that he says, it's not good that man should be alone. And he gave him a helper. He gave woman. And then we are designed for communion and community. That we cannot circumvent the design. You are designed for relationships. You have built-in relationships, family and all of that. But the church is designed as an organism. And it's constantly compared to a body. Not because we as Luma have all of the body parts here. But in the greater grand perspective of the picture, it's that it's a one entire organism, so that one thing can't say to the other thing, you don't need me. I'm useless. I'm tired. I can't give anything physically. Therefore, I'm not worth anything to the body. Well, that's not true. You're integral to the body. You're needed in the body. You can't say to the quote-unquote insignificant part or the unseen part that it's not needed or it's useless. Neither can the thing that is needed say to that, I don't need you. Nobody stands up and says, I alone am the reason why the church is existing. I carry all the weight, right? You're Peter, carrying all of it, and you're not supposed to. You're not expected to. And what's more is that if you run out ahead or lag behind and you're not with Jesus, you miss the journey. You miss the teaching. You sleep through the prayers, right? The ministry is designed for everybody to go through it together, to help one another on the journey. We want to be Paul in this story. But you know what I want you to be? I want you to be the brothers from Three Taverns. I want you to be the brothers from the Appian city, right? They run 44 miles. You will not run 44 miles for anything if you're carrying any weight. You've got to throw it all down. You've got to trust that the purpose that you're called for is not just for yourself, but it's for others. It's to help others along the way and be a redemptive presence every opportunity you get. I think Psalm 23 is probably the ultimate journey scripture. We all know it, but I want you to see, just like from the outset, that the whole context of us trusting God on a journey starts with, the Lord is my shepherd. And I want you to see, that's not a throwaway line just to get you in the idea of being a sheep. It's the shepherd is the one that provides. The shepherd's the one that directs. He's the one that says, here's where we're going. He says, here's how far we're going. He said, we're gonna stop here and we're gonna rest for a little while. Or we're gonna go and we gotta hike a big mountain. And you're gonna see that he'll lead us places that we don't necessarily wanna go, that we had not anticipated. And yet he's doing it for our good, but always for his name's sake. And then we see the second half of that says, I shall not want. And you might hear this as a prohibition. Tisk, tisk. You don't want anything. You shouldn't want anything. Shame on you for being in need. That's not what it's saying. It's a promise. Because the Lord is my shepherd, I will never want for anything. If you want for something, it's possible your eyes are fixed on the wrong thing. Whatever God wants you to have, he will give you. Now, you may have to ask for that thing, seek it in prayer, right? He wants you to come to him. That's just for free this morning. But I shall not want is not a prohibition. It's you have to trust God as your provider and the way maker and the way keeper and the leader, okay? And he's going to provide for you along the way. And he makes us lie down in green pastures. We love that one. I love green pastures. I like lying down. I want to sleep late. Not as late as my wife, but that's okay. I can't do it, okay? He leads me beside still waters. We like the still waters because those are nice and we can fish and do all the nice things, right? He restores my soul, but he leads me in paths of righteousness. And that means that your way is set by what is best for you. He's going to lead you in a righteous way, not in a way that will make you soft and fat, but he will keep you in a way that is good for you, that will raise you up, nurture you, mature you into the nice, good, faithful sheep that you should be. He will keep you from those things. The paths of righteousness are so that he's glorified as the good shepherd, not so that you're glorified as the perfect sheep. The path of righteousness is for his namesake because he's good and you will honor it and he will be given glory through your life. And even though you know this one, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, which is the deep darkness, the deep, deep darkness, it's emphatic. I will fear no evil. Why? Because you're with me. Your presence is with me. Lo, I'm with you always. Go in conquering. I'm with you. And the way that God is most with us is not in figmentive, I'm journeying with Jesus. You have, yes, his spirit with you, but do you know how Christ is manifest to you? Do you know what manifest means? Made visible. He's manifest to you in the person on your right and your left, the person behind you. The body of Christ is the manifestation of Christ to you. I am with you. Are you trying to go it alone? So that's the other reason why you're probably tired. Or you feel like you don't have anything to offer because you're on your own and you're moseying your way through and you're dragging stuff along that you probably don't need and you're not using any of the community that you've been given to encourage you, to help you struggle through those things, right? And you're not there to help them and to encourage them through the struggle. Cannot live isolated lives thinking that I will complete my own journey for my own ends. You're surrounded by the cloud of witnesses. That's your testimony to keep going forward. If you try to self-motivate and self-get through, you're not letting God be your shepherd or your provider for anything. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Now, these are important. The rod is the guiding correction, and the staff was to defend. God's given us his word to help guide us through. He's given us the spirit so we can be guided into truth. He defends us from unrighteousness, from those that cause evil against us. But even the things that happen to us are for his glory and our good so that many may be kept alive today. And here we go. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. That even in the midst of people that are in opposition to the gospel, people that are in opposition to the church, things that we think that we can't overcome, you cannot. But yet in the midst of that, there's a table of peace and provision. That we can come knowing that we have communion with God and he's providing. You anoint my head with oil, a picture of the spirit, my cup overflows. He doesn't just pour a little bit of wine, just enough for today, but so much so that it should bountifully flow out on others who are around us. And surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And I just want to stop and end on this word. Not that at the end of my journey, if I do this right, I'll get to the house of the Lord. He says, this is the picture of dwelling in the house of the Lord. I'm already there and I'll stay there because of him. I get to be in the house of the Lord in the community of faith. The picture that you have right now is a picture of the kingdom. It's not perfect. We mess it up all the time. But God's goodness to us is provisioning us on the journey, not always with stuff, but primarily with people. God's mission is not to get a bunch of stuff, but to redeem people. And you are one of those people. And he wants to use your life journey as a redeeming presence, like a little magically flowering thing everywhere that you go. So the kingdom is spread wherever you go. And you're not responsible for what that looks like, what that fruit bears, but you are responsible for it in faith, trusting him with the provision. Yes and amen. Yes? Okay. With That being said, we see Paul arrive in Rome, and we've got, I'll say 2 weeks, don't hold me to it, but 2 weeks left in the book of Acts. And so I want you to see that as Paul's sort of maybe drawing to the close of his journey, it's not really the close of his journey, it's been passed off, and here we are supposed to be carrying that on. And we should see the testimony. We can just add Paul to Hebrews 11. Just one more in the cloud of witnesses that tells us what a faithful life bears. And if you're like, I don't know if I can make, I don't know what to do, I don't know if I can run hard, you don't have to. It's not about the physical effort that you can give. There's so many other ways to contribute. But what are the things that God has given you? What stone has he actually asked you to carry? And then how many other ones are you dragging along that you don't need? Some of those being sin. It is sin to do things that you know God hasn't called you to do that are just self-fulfilling. If you know what's better. So God's calling you to what's best. So my commendation is just trust him in faith. He's our good shepherd. He will lead, guide, and provide. Father, we love you.